to The Fearless Flyer, and this is episode 3. We're going to be talking about aircraft design and lift. My name's Grant, and with me, my co-host, James. How are you, James?
Yeah, not too bad. Looking forward to discussing this one. That's a good basis for people and their knowledge to help them start not overthinking flying.
I thoroughly enjoyed our interview with Dr. Saif on the last episode. There's some really interesting insight into what he says about how people can overcome their fear of flying and the basic concepts that things that they can do to hopefully reduce their fear of flying. And maybe one day with this information we're providing, they might enjoy flying. So yeah, that's interesting.
Yes. So what is the basic, like the concept of aircraft design? Like why are they designed the way that they're designed as such?
Basically, when it comes to designing an aircraft, you've got a whole lot of balances to meet. So you've got competing requirements. You've got to produce an aircraft that it's strong, it's lightweight, but it's also got to be economical, and it's got to carry as much weight as it can, which is payload. And it has to do all this and be sufficiently reliable, and also the big issue, it's got to be safe for the design life of the aircraft. Now, the safety of an aircraft is paramount, because if you have aircraft that are unsafe, no one will want to buy them, and because no one will want to fly in them. So that's the competing requirements for designing an aeroplane. There's a whole lot of engineers sit around and they're all arguing. The structural guys want a massive structure because it's safe and it's sound. Aerodynamic guys want a thin structure because there's less drag. Payload specialists want as much room in the aircraft as possible because they want to carry as much payload. The fuel guy wants to have as big a fuel tank. So everyone's arguing and they're all having a go at each other to come up with a design that is basically that's safe, efficient, and reliable. So you can see a lot of competing requirements there.
Yes, so it's basically, as an overall sort of summary, it's just the commercial aircraft manufacturer, what they want to do is make an aircraft, first and foremost, is safe. Like, no one wants to fly on a plane, regardless of how fast or how much it can carry, if it's not safe. But they want to carry as much payload as far as possible, using the least amount of fuel. It's like the overall sort of way to summarize that.
Yep, that's the overall concept. And of course, the people that control this are the regulators. And in the United States, you have the FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Authority. And in Europe, you have EASA, which is the European Aviation Safety Agency. And these authorities oversee the final concept as such, and make sure that it's tested and that regulations that have been put into place govern the safety and the longevity of this aeroplane. Ultimately, the FAA and EASA couldn't care less about how much payload it carries. They're concerned 100% with safety. Now, nothing can be 100% safe anywhere in the world, but it has become a lot safer, and the regulators have ensured that we don't have aeroplanes falling out of the sky.
Yeah, well, it's like coming back to something that everyone can relate to is cars. You wouldn't want to go in a car that is really unsafe and has bits falling off, or is going to break down every half an hour. So why would you want to be in a plane? And there have been some historically larger events of the same sort of model of aircraft that have had incidents, which has led to the public like having a bad reputation. I believe you wanted to mention one of those sorts of cases in the past.
Yeah, there was one many years ago, and it's probably a lot of people forgotten about it, but the McDonnell Douglas DC-10 had a very bad reputation to start with. It had a number of design flaws, and it went even to the point where the FAA withdrew the certification for the aircraft and grounded it for around about 5 weeks in 1979. And the purpose of that there is because there was a number of issues, and at the end of the day, the FAA probably may not have done enough oversight, I don't know, but it did get a bad reputation very early on. But the aircraft turned out to be a very good aircraft, and I think passengers probably started to forget about the early incidents, and then it went on to have a very good track record afterwards. I know two pilots that flew it thought it was a lovely aeroplane to fly. So coming back to more modern times, James, there has been a aircraft that probably most people who read the newspapers on the planet know about, a very popular aircraft that's caused problems in more modern times.
Yes, so a Boeing 737 MAX series back in 2017, I believe it was, or early 2018. It had two, I think it was the end of 2017, had its first crash, and then a few months later had a secondary crash, which was very unfortunate. It was their largest selling family of aircraft. And it was also unfortunate because of, although there were design flaws, which later got proven through a lot of bureaucracy and the FAA and all the safety boards, like reviewing this aircraft and looking really deeply into all of its systems, but because of these two incidents had happened in places where pilot safety is known for not being as good, there was quite a lot of controversy over if it was the pilots or if it was the aircraft at the beginning of the investigation. But that was all later proven to be mainly to do with the aircraft, and it had a few design flaws. But again, it was grounded for 2 years, I believe, just over two years. Well, it just come back into service, and most people, I think, who have any knowledge of the situation would come to say it's probably one of the safest aircraft. It's been the most scrutinized aircraft in history, and probably it's one of the safest aircraft to fly on now due to how heavily scrutinized it's been by the regulators.
Yeah, James, that's interesting. The 737 MAX is the latest in the series of the Boeing 737 family, of which over 10,000 of these 737s have been manufactured. The MAX will probably be the most scrutinized aircraft ever manufactured due to the systemic failures by the manufacturer and the regulator, despite the rigorous testing procedures that are supposed to be in place. With new aircraft, there'll always be unforeseen problems that might come to light during like commercial operations, and the manufacturer and or the regulator will address this problem with something like a maintenance instruction or say a pilot procedure, which can remedy the problem as a temporary solution or maybe as a permanent fix to the problem. So going a bit further, in addition to the Boeing 777, which I currently fly, I've also flown the Boeing 757, 767, and 737s, a few different series there. I've never flown the 737 MAX. However, on the Boeing 777, and as all Boeings, we have memory items, and some of them are common across all the aircraft. But there are memory items, and I'm required to memorize them for that aircraft, and I'm tested on them on a regular basis. The MAX had a problem, and basically a memory checklist procedure was developed, and it was highlighted to the operators. I feel that in these two accidents, these memory items may have been misinterpreted. But without getting into too much detail, as we'll discuss these two accidents in another series, suffice to say the aircraft was grounded until a permanent fix was made rather than just using the memory items that were developed and which would have been sufficient.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I feel that as aviation is global, these manufacturers are from set countries. Yeah, the memory items, it's quite easy to misinterpret them through language barriers and culture barriers, etc. As we mentioned, we will be touching on this in the upcoming episode. But yeah, apart from that, what else can you tell us about the aircraft structure and sort of the testing around that?
The aircraft structures are designed and tested to ensure that they can take a hell of a lot more than what you or I could imagine. They use historic information on the worst weather that's ever occurred around the world, and that's how the aircraft design is designed to the worst case scenario. So you're not looking at an aircraft structure that's designed just for strength, but you're looking for elasticity, durability, resistance to damage, such as a ground vehicle hitting it. You're looking at stability, fail-safe options, corrosion resistance, and you're looking at ease of maintaining the aircraft as well. The structure's got to be able to withstand many other issues such as cabin pressurizations, hard landings, turbulence, vibrations, and during testing, there can be up to about 10,000 points that are tested on a new aircraft alone. And there is a schedule by which the regulators enforce that the plane has to meet all these safety criteria before it's released. Ultimately, if there's a problem with the aircraft, the market will dictate that no one will want to fly in it, therefore no one's going to buy it. It is important that the plane is tested and that the manufacturer is honest with their own testing, because it's going to affect the longevity and reputation of that aircraft.
Yeah, well, I feel with the whole testing thing, a lot of people are scared of flying. They're scared of, like, they look out the window of a plane and they see the wings flapping around and stuff, and they're like wondering how it works. And I think us discussing how wing loading is tested is probably quite a good thing, just to sort of reassure people who are scared of flying, because they do flex a lot throughout all phases of flight. Even just when you're just refueling on the ground, they'll sag down a bit as the wing tanks fill up. So do you just want to talk about, just on your aircraft, the 777, sort of what, like, how much they can flex?
Yeah, James, that's really interesting. You bring up the loads of an aircraft in the design, because it is something the passenger sees. What the passenger doesn't see is that the aircraft is tested all over, the fuselage as well. But the things that the passengers see are the wings. And like you've already alluded to, when they're filling up with fuel, they sag down. And when they take off, they lift up. So there are a number of loads that the aircraft's tested to. And the first one's a limit load. So the limit load is defined as the maximum load that an aircraft can expect to see at any point during its life. And that takes into account a lot of stuff like the worst gusts that a plane's had in the past, just historical information that they've put into the design of the aeroplane. During the flight, we have as pilots limitations that are built into the aircraft to make sure that we fly the aeroplane within the limit load. But unbeknown to a lot of people, there's also another load which is tested on the aeroplane, and this is called the ultimate load. And a manufacturer does not expect, or a regulator, to see the aircraft ever go to the ultimate load. But the reason why it's tested to the ultimate load is an additional safety factor to account for unexpected events such as sudden severe gust load stronger than what's ever been experienced by any aeroplane in the world. And so this ultimate load test is 1.5 times the limit load, so 150% of the limit load test.
When you mean gust load, is that just, do you mean a huge storm, like if there's a gust of a wind as such, just for the people out there?
Okay, so the gust load, it's generally something like a momentarily upward flow of wind on a wing, which artificially increases the load on the wing. So what that's doing, it's making the weight of the aircraft appear heavier. So that's what I'm referring to when I talk about the gust load. Basically, if you were flying in a severe storm, there is a lot of gusts going up and down. And the historic data of flying in the worst storm has been accounted for in the limit load of the aeroplane. But now what they're saying is that something's out of control. We need an additional safety factor of 150% of the what we expect in an aeroplane to be the ultimate load test. So this is just an additional safety factor that goes way and above what you or I could comprehend. So these safety factors ensures the aircraft doesn't fail. The aircraft's a heck of a lot stronger than anyone can imagine. Everyone does look out at the wing of an aeroplane, and they sit there and they see it flexing around. The first thing is, the flexing around's really good. So if you're flying on a Boeing 777, which is the planes I'm familiar with at the moment, during normal flight, the wing will flex at the tip around plus or minus just under 3 meters. And that is around 9 feet. So that'll flex during normal flight. However, when they tested the aeroplane, remember we talked about the limit load, they test it to the ultimate load. So what they do at Boeing, they put a whole lot of cables and jacks all over the wing. Then they flex it vertically, and they're going to flex it up vertically until it breaks. Now, what they've worked out is that the wing would break at about 24 feet. 24 feet is about 7.5 meters. They flexed this wing and they flexed it up, and it eventually broke at 28 feet. So that's from sitting level straight up, they flexed it. That's 8.5 meters. And remember, the designers had said, we're going to design this, it can't break at less than 150% of the load that we expected to. So it actually broke eventually at 154%. So if you were sitting in that aeroplane with your face right up against the window, looking at that wing, you probably wouldn't even be able to see the wing tip. Once it passes probably about 6 meters, 20 feet, you wouldn't be able to see it. So if you think about it, that's a phenomenal amount of flex. And the big thing about a wing flexing, and the more important thing, unbeknown to the passengers, it actually makes it for a much smoother ride. So if the plane's solid and it doesn't flex at all, a lot of vibration goes to the aeroplane. It's really uncomfortable. The fact that the wings are flexing makes it a lot smoother. So yeah, I would expect the wing to flex, and if the wing's not flexing, I wouldn't really be happy. Obviously, in straight and level flight, when it's nice and smooth, the wing just sits there. But fighter. As you roll down the runway, it's got all that fuel in it, and the plane starts to lift off. The wing will flex up a meter, maybe a meter and a half, because now the weight is shifted to the wings from the wheels, and the plane is sitting on those wings. And when it's going through turbulence, it'll do its flexing, and that's how it's designed. So yeah, flexibility in the wings is important.
So really, it's quite like a car suspension, if you think about it. Like, if you didn't have a suspension in your car and you start going over speed bumps, it's going to feel like a lot more than if you have a nice suspension, which sort of bounces up and down. So basically, the wings, the suspension of the aircraft in flight.
Yeah, that's it. And it's designed to flex. So enjoy those flexing wings and enjoy that ride. So what are some of the other things that we test the plane for that might be of interest to people there, James?
Well, because obviously you've not just got a pair of wings on an aircraft that make it fly. You've got other things such as the engines. And although a plane can fly if its engines did fail, which I'm sure we'll get into later on, I think it's one episode 20-something when we go into redundancies, but they do test to see how much sort of the breaking point of engines. So they'll practice bird strikes, because obviously birds are around at lower levels of flight for all aircraft. So they throw dead chickens and things into the engine when they're going, testing them on the ground just to see what actually happens in the engine, see what parts break or what needs reinforcing, just to really get the safety of that engine out. Obviously, other parts of the aircraft, everything really needs testing to a high degree, but they'll be doing other testing such as acceleration tests, where you're doing really steep turns or stalling the aircraft at heights to see how it recovers and how the aerodynamics really work in a practical situation. You need to be doing vibration testing on the aircraft, so that obviously when you're taxiing around or when you're in flight, there's a lot of vibrations, especially from the engines going through that fuselage, and you don't want any rivets or screws coming out. So you need to make sure everything's staying in place and secure. And lastly, they test all temperatures, because obviously a plane might be going from where you guys are in the Middle East when it's 45 degrees in the day, say over to America where it might be winter, or Canada, and you might be going to minus 20 degrees, and the plane needs to be able to operate the same as it would in 50 degrees as it would in minus 20. So they do a lot of testing flying into extreme weather places, making sure that everything sort of works. And those are just a few of the hundreds and hundreds of tests, and that's why it takes sometimes a few years for these new aircraft to get certified for commercial operations.
Yeah, you're right. They do spend a long time testing. A few other interesting tests. There's lightning tests. So because planes, they are designed to get hit by lightning, and there's never been a problem with airplane hit by lightning. I'll talk about that more in episode, I think, around 8 or 9.
Redundancy one.
I talk about it more in weather, during weather.
Oh, fair enough.
The other one that they do is fatigue testing. So the airplane, they simulate it going through many flights, pressurization cycles, and I think that can take up, that's just going 24 hours a day. I think they do it over 18 months to 2 years. But coming back to the interesting one on the engines, when they test the engines, you talked about throwing chickens at them. There's also another test they do when they actually blow one of the fan blades. It detaches, and they intentionally detach this fan blade while the engine's running at full power, and it has to be contained within the engine. And the engine's actually on the GE90, the ones I run, the engine was still running, it was vibrating a lot, but it has to be contained within the engine. So yeah, there's a heck of a lot of testing that's done on these things. It's a really quite an amazing amount of testing done, and comes back to what we were saying right at the start of this podcast. If you manufacture a plane that has a lot of issues, the reputation for the airplane's pretty much kaput. No one wants to fly in it. People don't want to, companies don't want to buy it, and it's never going to work. So it's in their best interests to follow the regulatory authorities and make sure the plane is tested thoroughly to ensure that throughout the longevity of a life, it's got a good reputation.
So yeah, we'll be covering more of this sort of redundancies and all these sort of testing throughout later episodes as we go delve into a deeper sort of insight into all these different sort of tests they do and redundancy systems in place. But now we need to get onto the second part of the podcast, which is talking about lift. Because I think a lot of people, when they hear the word lift, they don't actually know what it means. So the way we're going to do this is I'm just going to say the lift formula, and then Grant is going to go through a bit of it, and I'll go through another part of the formula, just so that you guys know how lift occurs and how, like in flight, like lift changes and how an aircraft can gain more lift or reduce lift. So the basic formula, James,
the dreaded lift formula. We've got to keep this nice and simple, because I remember learning this.
Formula to lift.
Yeah, the formula to lift used to be a little bit confusing, but we'll make it nice and simple. Have a go.
So lift equals the coefficient of the wing, so that's a lot of different numbers together, times by the density, there's a fraction, so it's the density times by velocity squared divided by 2 times by the wing surface area. Now, on our social media forum, we'll post a photo of it so you can visualize this. It's a lot easier to visualize than actually say the formula through. But what is the coefficient then, Grant, in that lift formula?
Okay, so the coefficient is, it's basically when a wing is designed, it's given a coefficient of lift. So if you want to look at a brick and a ball, and they're in the airflow. Now, if you're sitting there with a square brick, as wind hits it, it's going to have a lot of disturbed airflow. It's not going to be as efficient as flowing over a smooth ball. So they do a whole lot of testing, and you'd find that there'd be a different coefficient of lift given to the brick and another one to the ball. And the coefficient lift in the ball would obviously be easier because air can flow around it a bit smoother than flying around a brick. It's the shape of the wing and the angle at which it's hitting the airflow. That's probably the most complicated part of the lift formula. The rest of it's pretty straightforward. You've got speed, so the faster you go, the more lift. You've got how big the wing is, so a bigger wing will obviously generate more lift. And the last one is the density of the air. So down near the Earth's surface, very thick air, lots of lift. At altitude, very low air, less lift.
Yeah, and so in a plane, the way we can change this, because obviously the one thing you can't really change in a plane in flight is the coefficient of the wing. So that in order to change the amount of lift that our aircraft and wing is getting in flight, we have to change one of the other values. Air density, if you really wanted to in the middle of flight and you're up at cruise and you wanted to get more lift, you could descend because obviously the air is getting thicker and then there's more airflow sort of going over the wing, the air's denser, and that will create more lift. Or, as you know, take off, you're getting faster because you need to get enough air over that wing in order to take off. So speed's a big thing. And then the wing area, people often wonder about flaps and slats, which we're getting into another episode. I'm fairly sure that's a whole episode on its own. Basically, all the flaps and slats do is they come out and increase the wing area, and therefore lift can be increased.
I'm pretty sure every listener has put their hand out of a car window when you're going along and felt the airflow over your hand. So if you're not on a road, a public road, and you're driving along and you want to experiment with the lift form of your hand, if you put your hand out flat with all your fingers out and adjust it back up and down as you're going along, you'll feel it wants to lift. Conversely, if you just put 2 fingers out, you'll feel less lift. And as you twist your hand, you'll twist it up. You'll feel the airflow hitting the bottom and it's trying to force your hand up. That's your angle of attack. And obviously, the faster you go with a given angle attack, the more lift you'll generate.
No, I just think people should know it's not as scary as I know it seems. If we haven't explained it, obviously check out the visual we'll post later on our social media pages and you'll visually see it. And if you play back the podcast whilst visually seeing this formula, hopefully it all makes sense. If it doesn't, obviously get in touch with us and we'll be happy to answer any of your questions.
There is 2 arguments to lift, and it's been a lot of debate going on in flying for years. They say that less pressure on top of the wing causes the wing to be sucked up, and that's a theory called Bernoulli's theorem. But there's also Newton's theory, which is that for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction, and that could be the same as a stone skimming across the water. As it hits the water, it gets pushed up. Really, it's a combination of both that occur on a wing to create lift. So there's less pressure on the top and also pressure underneath. So there are 2 arguments to lift, but you get the concept with the hand analogy out of the window. So the majority of our controls on an aeroplane that manipulate it through the air use the lift formula, whether it's decreasing lift or increasing lift. So we have controls that help us, ailerons, elevators, flaps, slats, speed brakes. We'll all talk about that in a later episode, but everything on the aeroplane that helps control it is derived from the lift formula. Yeah, are you happy with that? Have you got anything else you want to add there on the lift part of it, James?
It's easy to say all these numbers and show an equation, but I feel like it'd be easier to visualize for the listener just to go and watch a YouTube video of a plane taking off, and you can see exactly what we're talking about when we talk about the wing flexing and the wings taking the weight as the wheels lift off the floor.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we can add that into the show notes. having a look at a recap on what we've looked at here, we've talked about designing and testing. We've used a lot of historical data over the last 100 years. We've seen improvements in technology, computer design. Unfortunately, things like wars have added to an increase of design and understanding. Commercial competition has advanced the way aircraft design's been done. We've also had an improvement, a significant improvements in the materials in which we use. And through data, feedback, and analysis of many historical events, we've got a better understanding of how to design aircraft so that they meet all the criteria to make sure that they're very safe. And something that once we hope you understand will help you appreciate that sitting in a car, I would say the airplane is designed a heck of a lot better than a car. And with this information that we're presenting to you now, we're hoping that it'll make you a little bit more at ease with how it's been designed, and also having a basic understanding, reduce that unknown thing to hopefully make you a fearless flyer.
But I hope that what we've discussed about lift and aircraft design, you can now go next time you're on a plane, or even, yeah, as I said, go and just watch a video just to put your mind at ease, see that the plane is designed to do that. The wings are meant to flex and they are meant to create lift, meant to give you a smoother journey. And yeah, I hope it sort of just put you at ease and you're not as scared of flying as you were before listening to the podcast.
Yeah, that sounds good. So we're going on to episode 4 next. Well, what's involved with episode 4 there, James?
So we're doing not so much more on lift, but talking about the whole fourth main forces of what happens to an aircraft in flight. So we've got lift, obviously, which we've discussed today, and then we're going into weight, thrust, and drag, and all four of those, how they combine to sort of make the aircraft fly.
Yeah, I agree with you, James. Those are the four fundamental forces that we face when we're flying an aeroplane, and those forces are constantly in balance, and they're sometimes out of balance when we want to maneuver the aeroplane. But there's something interesting to talk about because those are the fundamental four forces that are involved in flying. So from me, it's goodbye. Thank you for listening. And from James,
yeah, we'll see you later. And hopefully we're slowly putting your mind at ease about flying.